is titled The Heart's Release, Abiding in the Immeasurables. And it could have a subtitle called The Lion's Roar. The Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings, also sometimes called the immeasurables, loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, sympathetic or empathetic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. Each and all of these immeasurable capacities, perfectly natural, absolutely natural aspects of our humanness. Natural, ordinary aspects of our humanness. And at the same time, extraordinary capacities of being. As they mature, and in their fullness and maturity, they're some of the qualities, some of the capacities of a Buddha, a liberated being. The heart's release, the liberation of the heart. This evening, I'd like to explore with you some of the particulars of these immeasurable threads. We've looked at quite a bit around metta and some around compassion, karuna. So explore more and some of the the threads that we haven't explored, mudita and upekkha. And also look at how they weave together, supporting, sustaining, and balancing each other, creating a tapestry of a clear, caring, appropriate responsivity, this ability to respond rather than react to whatever life offers. To respond with metta, respond with karuna, mudita, upekkha. This capacity to respond from the heart of immeasurable impartiality, embracing all sentient beings, not just those who are close to us in our life, or are useful to us in some way, or are pleasing to us in particular ways, or amusing to us in particular ways. This evening's talk is filled with lots of stories, not so much a didactic explanation, but lots of stories. I'd actually like to begin with something I already offered. I think the first night, just a short quote again from Krishnamurti's journal, his meditation journal. When the heart enters into the mind has quite a different quality. It is then really limitless. It's a sense of living in a vast space where you're part of everything. Meditation is the movement of love. It isn't the love of the one or of the many. It's like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthenware. It's inexhaustible. metta. When this, a sense of separation, a sense of distinction, of difference, any sense of discrimination, when any sense of discrimination has disappeared, is absent, this is metta. This can be called love. And it's the ground, it's the bed of all of the other divine abidings, the ground that they spring from. And it's really what allows the whole of our practice to unfold from and into with this core of kindness, patience, both in relation to ourselves and in relation to others. This patient kindness, this generosity of being, it brings us to abide in our life, which includes abide in our meditation practice, in a way that allows us to approach and receive, to open to be fully present with any moment at all, no matter what is happening within our body or all around us. To be fully present with this expansive openness and a great respect and an honoring of the moment, however it is. It's really a very strong, very clear place. There's quite a beautiful story in the Anguttara Nikaya Sutta that talks about this in a beautiful way. It's the story of Shariputra's lion's roar. That's how it's described. And it shows this quality of clear strength, this clear strength of the heart very clearly. It was just after the completion of the 3 months rainy season retreat during the time of the Buddha. And the monks were all dispersing for their various duties and their various responsibilities in other places. One monk came to the Buddha, and he reported that as Shariputra was leaving, that this monk had tried to ask him a question. But Shariputra, without answering the question, had pushed him down, pushed him to the ground, and not apologized. After the Buddha heard this, he summoned Shariputra to come before the assembly of monks and nuns, the ones that were still there, and asked Shariputra if this was true. And this is Shariputra's response. In response to the Buddha and to the assembly of monks and nuns. Lord, I remember the discourse you gave 12 years ago to Bhikkhu Rahula. Rahula was the Buddha's son. The discourse you gave 12 years ago to Bhikkhu Rahula when he was 18 years old. You taught him to contemplate the nature of earth, water, fire, and air in order to nourish and to develop the virtues of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Although your teaching was directed to Rahula, I also learned from it And I've tried to observe that observe and practice that teaching. Lord, I've tried to practice like the earth. The earth is wide and open and has the capacity to receive, embrace, and transform. Whether people toss pure and fragrant substances such as flowers, perfumes, or fresh milk upon the earth, or toss unclean and foul-smelling substances like excrement, urine, blood, mucus, and spit upon the earth receives them all equally, without grasping, without aversion. No matter what you throw into the earth has the power to receive, embrace, and transform. I try my best to practice like the earth, to receive without resisting, complaining, or suffering. Lord, I practice mindfulness and loving kindness. A monk who does not practice mindfulness of the body in the body, of the actions of the body in the actions of the body, could knock down a fellow monk and leave him lying there without apologizing. But it is not my way to be rude to a fellow monk, to push him to the ground and walk on without apologizing. I've learned the lessons you've offered to Rahula to practice like the water. Whether someone pours a fragrant substance or an unclean substance into the water receives them all equally, without grasping or aversion. Water is immense and flowing and has the capacity to receive, contain, transform, and purify all things. I've tried my best to practice like water. A monk who does not practice mindfulness, who does not practice becoming like water, might push a fellow monk to the ground and go on his way without saying, "I'm sorry." I'm not such a monk. I've practiced to be more like fire. Fire burns everything, the pure as well as the impure, the beautiful as well as the distasteful, without grasping or aversion. If you throw flowers or silk into it, it burns. If you throw old cloth or other foul-smelling things into it, the fire will accept and burn everything. It doesn't discriminate. Why? Because fire can receive, consume, and burn everything offered to it. I've tried to practice like fire. A monk who does not practice mindfulness of looking, listening, and contemplating might push a fellow monk to the ground and go on without apologizing. Lord, I'm not such a monk. I've tried to practice to be more like air. The air carries all smells, good and bad, without grasping or aversion. The air has the capacity to purify and transform and release. Lord Buddha, I've contemplated the body in the body, the movements of the body in the movement of the body, the positions of the body in the positions of the body, the feelings in the feelings, and the mind in the mind. A monk who does not practice mindfulness might push a fellow monk to the ground and go on without apologizing. I am not such a monk. My Lord, I am like an untouchable child with nothing to wear, with no title or any medal to put on my tattered cloth. I've tried to practice humility because I know that humility has the power to transform. I've tried to learn every day. A monk who does not practice mindfulness can push a fellow to the ground, push a fellow monk to the ground, and go on without apologizing. I am not such a monk. As Shariputra continued to deliver his lion's roar, the other monk could stand it no longer. And he bared his right shoulder, and he knelt down and he begged for forgiveness. He said to the Buddha, I've transgressed the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the rules of monastic discipline. I've transgressed the Vinaya. Out of anger and jealousy, I told a lie to discredit my elder brother in the Dharma. I beg the community to allow me to practice and to begin anew. In front of the Buddha and the whole Sangha, he bowed three times to Shariputra. When Shariputra saw his brother bowing, he bowed and said, I've not been skillful enough, and that's why I have created misunderstanding. I am co-responsible for this, and I beg my brother monk to forgive me. And then he bowed three times to the other monk, and they reconciled. And so we begin the practice of loving kindness, unconditional friendship with ourselves, as we have, and expand outwards from here, as we have, as we are. And eventually, through this practice, connecting with and encompassing every form of life on the planet, every form of life in the universe, those seen and unseen. And we begin to really develop and embody a love that is truly great, as the Buddhist nun said, the poem that I read, a love that's rid of the desire to possess, a strong, clear love. A dignified love, a cool and refreshing love, a love that's soft but not weak, the love that leads to enlightenment. During this past year, I read a book that's called Life is So Good, and it's a book about and by a man named George Dawson, who's 103 years old. He's a black man who lives in Texas, who's still very alive and well at 100, maybe he's almost 104 by now, actually. He grew up on his family's farm in East Texas, and he's the grandson of slaves. At the age of 8, George had to go to work to help support his family. So he never attended school and he never learned how to read until he decided to attend a literacy program, actually just a few years ago at the age of 98. It's a very amazing and very inspiring and very illuminating book. George describes how he learned to read the world, we could say, and to survive in it. At one point in the book, George is having a conversation with Richard, who helped him write the book. And they're talking about how George, who at the age of 101, is still living alone and doing just fine, as George said, I'm doing just fine. And this is a conversation between Richard and George. Richard speaking. You aren't really alone. People call and come by all day long. There's a community of people that cares about you. You live by yourself, but no, you're not really alone. George. That's right. You figured that out. Yes, it's nice that people stop by like they do. But they do that because they want to. I have nothing to give them. But they always feel better when they leave. Richard, that sounds like a riddle. George, it does, doesn't it? I'll tell you the answer for that. All my life I've been good to people. In all those years, every person I've met, I've treated with respect. People do the same for me. Richard, what goes around comes around. George, that's right. It all comes back, everything you do. Sometimes it might take a while, is all. I tell people not to worry about things, not to worry about their lives. Things will be all right. People need to hear that. Life is good just as it is. There isn't anything I would change about my life. Richard, people worry too much? George, that's right. Be happy for what you have. Help someone instead of worrying. It will make a person feel better. It's good to be generous. It doesn't take much to make a difference. Even the poorest man can take time to say hello. That can be a help. Have some sympathy for someone's hard luck story. It's not about money. Give what you can. And if you have nothing, at least pray for somebody. Have good thoughts. For much of his life, George endured the very deeply pervasive racism and segregation in the South. During the time that he was growing up in East Texas had the highest rate of lynchings of any state in the Union. And the book actually begins with George at the age of 8 witnessing the lynching of a teenage boy, a young black teenage boy who was a kind of George's hero in his early childhood. When he was 65 years old, George was doing work for a woman, yard work, gardening and lawn work, for a woman who left his lunch on the back porch with her dogs. And this is George speaking. She didn't see me from the shadow of the tree, but I watched as she put down two bowls on the floor for some dogs, and another she set up on the shelf that was above the reach of the dogs. I climbed up onto the porch and lifted the bowl off the shelf. It looked good, and as hungry as I was, it smelled even better. I was looking for a chair to sit in a quiet spot to say grace, when I looked down and saw the two dogs eating the same food that was there for me on the shelf. There wasn't such a surprise in that. People didn't buy dog food in sacks like they do now. Dogs mostly ate the leftovers from the table. But what hit me was that she expected that I would eat out on the porch with her dogs. I didn't have to eat in their dining room, but back in their kitchen would have been all right. I told myself that I was good enough to eat a meal with people, not dogs. I set the bowl back on the shelf. Being hungry, that wasn't easy. I know she didn't plan to insult me. She just didn't know better. Still, she could believe what she wanted. If I weren't no animal, I wasn't going to eat with dogs. If I did, she would go on believing that way, and maybe she would have been right. Late in the afternoon, just as I was finishing my work, she came by. "Didn't you see the lunch I left on the porch?" she said. I nodded. I saw the dogs on the porch. "Well, the lunch on the shelf was for you. It was a good lunch." "Thank you, I'm sure it was. It's just that I don't eat with dogs." As I said that, I looked her straight in the eye. I could tell she understood what I meant. She got angry and red in the face. But I didn't turn away. I didn't look down. "I eat with people. I'm a human being." At my words, her face tightened, and her look changed to meanness and anger. From her mother and father and back through her grandparents, I could see 100 years of anger and fear coming out towards me. I stood up to it, and I repeated, "I'm a human being." She was so angry she couldn't speak. I waited. Finally, in a cold tone, she said, "You don't need to come back anymore." I said, "That's right. I don't need to." And this is George speaking again. I figure you can't hate someone for what they think and do, but you can hate yourself for the unacceptable ways you react to it. George Dawson's Lion's Roar, clearly a lion's roar. The confidence, the strength, the straightforwardness that comes from a loving, compassionate heart. True love, metta love, comes from knowing, from an intuitive understanding of our essential connectedness in an impersonal way, our essential interconnectedness, connectedness, whether we know the beings or not. From this perspective, it's not about working to attain something, to get something, but rather allowing the practice, our spiritual practice of vipassana, of metta, of compassion, to be loving kindness, to be compassion, to allow the insight to arise as it naturally does. With the awakening heart of metta, of karuna, compassion, of mudita, empathetic joy or sympathetic joy, these notions that we have of me and of you, these fixed conceptual distinctions of me and you, begin to dissolve. They begin to dissolve in the way, in relation to the way that we go about our life, how we relate to this life, how we relate in this life. And there's this spontaneous empathetic response that begins to emerge quite naturally. An empathetic response to the difficulties, the sufferings, and an empathetic response to the joys in life. And again, from our friend from the other evening, Shanti Deva. I should dispel the pain of others because it hurts like my own. And I should be good to them because they feel just as I do. When both they and I are the same in wanting joy and not desiring pain, what's so special about me? And the same quote I spoke of the other night, when I act for the sake of others, no amazement or conceit arises. Just like feeding myself, I hope for nothing in return. About 15 years ago, when I was living in Nepal, one of my sons came over to visit me for a while. And during that visit, we went to a town called Pokhara. It's a beach town at the foot of the Himalayas. It's a point of departure for treks up into the Annapurna Range. And a lot of people come there to go up into the mountains. It's kind of a gathering place, a place to begin to trek up into the mountains. So there are a lot of tourists there, a lot of people from lots of different places, and lots of restaurants and accommodations, overnight accommodations. My son and I were sitting in an outdoor cafe having lunch one day in Pokhara, and over the loudspeaker in this cafe, and it was coming to the outside where we were sitting out on the porch, was a very loud playing a song, Madonna. And she was singing "It's a Material World." As my son and I were watching Nepal go by on this little street, this a little sand dirt street in front of the restaurant. And as we were sitting there eating, listening to Madonna yelling "It's Material World," this man came by on a cart. He was a leper. He didn't have any legs. And he was pushing himself along on this little cart with hands that were missing some fingers or parts of fingers, using his knuckles. And he came right in front of us, and right coming the other direction was a calf, a youngish calf, about a teenager calf. And they stopped. They came and met each other and stopped right in front of my son and I. And the calf started licking the man. And the man was obviously very delighted that the calf was licking him. And he took off his... He was very dirty, besides not having his whole body to himself. He took off his cap, and as the calf was licking him, and the calf licked him all over his head, and he took off his shirt, his torn and dirty T-shirt, and the calf licked his whole body. And he gave himself to the calf and turned his body, and the calf licked him completely all over. And he was in ecstasy. He was absolutely happy as could be. He was getting his bath, for one thing. And the other thing is that you probably know cows are holy in India, so he wasn't just getting a bath. He was getting a holy bath. And to be realistic about the whole relationship, he was probably very salty because he was very dirty. He looked like he hadn't bathed for a long, long time, and it's hot there, so he'd sweated a lot. So the calf was getting salt as he was bathing the man. They were both very happy. And after the calf finished licking him pretty much all over, he threw his arms around the calf and just hugged him, and the calf very peacefully stayed there until the man finished his embrace, and then they each continued on their way. And my son and I we stopped eating, of course. Didn't actually, Madonna disappeared, you know, for a few moments. And then we looked at each other after they both had gone on their way, and tears were coming out of both of our eyes. Tears of compassion, tears of great empathetic joy, tears of metta. And there was Madonna still, you know. It's a material world. It's an amazing world that all of that could happen in 5 minutes in front of us. Empathetic joy. Oh, I sometimes think of it as contagious joy. Sympathetic, it's traditionally called sympathetic joy, but I feel like empathetic joy or even contagious joy is more descriptive of the experience. It's one of the factors of enlightenment, as well as one of the divine abidings, one of the immeasurable capacities of our heart. Delight, joy. Each of us, every one of us in this room, has experienced the benefits, the fruits of joy. These positive our joyous feelings, our attitudes, as they pass through our body, pass through our mind, and circulate through our whole system. We experience a physical and an energetic sense of transformation within this balance of body, heart, and mind. And it feels quite healthy when this energy of joy passes through us. We may in these moments feel unbound, we may feel healed. Mudita, joy. It makes the heart, makes the mind, makes the body light, pliable, open, relaxed. And all of these qualities, all of these qualities of joy, these visceral experiences, are very helpful towards our practice, towards our meditation practice. Very important aspect of practice. A couple of summers ago, I attended a retreat up in northern Colorado with a Tibetan teacher called Sokni Rinpoche. He's a young Dzogchen teacher, Tibetan Dzogchen teacher. The last evening of the retreat, Sokni Rinpoche invited a guest to give a talk. It was one of his teachers. His name was Adi Rinpoche. It was his first trip to the United States. Adi Rinpoche is a man in his 70s, mid-70s or so. And before he came to give us a Dharma talk, Sokni had given us a little bit of background information about him. And he told us that Adi Rinpoche was one of the finest artists that he knew. And he also told us that Adi Rinpoche had been in a Chinese prison for 20 years. When the Chinese came in into Tibet, they put him in prison. He'd been there for a long time. 15 of those 20 years that he was in prison, he and a couple of other lamas were practicing. They were in retreat. And this 15-year retreat, which wasn't the usual way that people were in Chinese prisons. It came about because of the kindness of one of the Chinese doctors at the prison who'd taken a liking to Adi Rinpoche and had created the conditions that made it possible for these three men to be in retreat for 15 years while they were in prison. It wasn't like a retreat like this, though. They were in prison. Sokni Rinpoche talks about Adi Rinpoche as being one of the last remaining antique lamas. I don't know if you know what that means. Really old style Tibetan lamas. There's not too many left. So our honored guest came in into the meditation hall with his somewhat stiff and somewhat bent body. It was a bit hard for him to climb up on the Tibetan, if you know Tibetan lamas, they're up about that high when they get higher when they give a talk. So he had to climb up and needed help. And he gave a very, very long talk, a couple of hours. And it was very clear, very traditional Dharma talk, kind of essentially laying out the path all the way from the beginning, Sila, all the way through the Dzogchen teachings and practices. And it wasn't a very exciting talk. There wasn't much humor in it. It was interesting enough, but it was okay, you know. But there was one particularly bright aspect of that evening, and it was Adi Rinpoche himself. Because as he spoke, there was this incredible lightness, an incredible suppleness, and incredible delight in his being that came through. And at times when he was talking, it seemed to me that he was kind of almost bouncing lightly off his seat. It was the closest thing I've ever seen to someone levitating. After the talk was finished, I felt like I needed to check my perception out with a couple of friends of mine that were also at the retreat to see if it was my misperception or was that really a quality that was happening. And at that retreat you could talk. It was hardly silent. So I asked my two friends, and they said they felt the same thing, saw the same thing, experienced the same thing. After the retreat was finished, there was a fundraising auction where various paintings and calligraphy that were done by Adi Rinpoche and Sokni Rinpoche were auctioned off to make money for this Tibetan center. And the women who had requested Adi Rinpoche to do a couple of paintings and to do some calligraphy for the auction told us that this one particular woman said she'd stayed with Adi Rinpoche the whole time that he was painting and doing his calligraphy. She'd stayed there with him. And she said that the whole time that he was painting, he was laughing with delight. Joy. Incredible joy. A man who was in prison for 20 years and who practiced deeply, very deeply. Incredible joy. Mudita, this feeling of delight, delight and happiness. In relation to the Brahma Viharas, it's the practice of, and it's considered the most difficult of the Brahma Viharas to cultivate in its purity. Joy for, joy with, happiness with, happiness for, very powerful energies. Delight and taking delight, feeling gladness in others' happiness, others' successes, in the good things that others have done, others' accomplishments, the good things that have happened to others, happened for others. And also all of that for ourself also, taking delight in the things we've done, the good things, our own successes, our own happinesses, the good things that have happened to us. Often in relation to others, there's a sense of maybe envy or jealousy or judgment. That's why it's considered the most difficult to cultivate, to experience in its purity. And when I was considering mudita at one point and looking for a very pure example from my own experience, a particular story came up in relation to one of my grandchildren. As conditions would have it, when one of my grandsons, who's now four, was 1 year old, he and I were alone together one morning. It happened to be the morning that was the first time he'd ever walked all the way across the room by himself. And as we all know from our own relationships with children, he'd been working up to it for quite a long time. But when it actually happened that morning, when we were alone together, he was remarkably delighted as he walked across the room. It was kind of like Adi Rinpoche. He laughed all the way across the room. And I, in turn, felt this tremendous delight and happiness and joy in his delight and his happiness with his accomplishment. The purity of mudita. Not necessarily at all because someone does something for us, or because of anyone either us or anyone else getting anything, possessing something. It's certainly possible to feel mudita in both of those cases also. A baby's first walking. My grandson wasn't walking for me, that's for sure. And he also wasn't walking for himself. It's the way of things. Walking happens at some point. And he was delighted, and so was I. We could say joy as grace. It happens. Traditionally, in the Buddhist texts, one of the metaphors for understanding the scope, the breadth, of the immeasurable abidings is through the relationship of a mother or a father to his or her child. An ideal relationship, actually. Not always like that, like this, but this is the metaphor, and I think it's it can be quite useful. Metta, the unconditional love. It's like the parent's relationship to the baby, or a very, very young child. That of complete unconditional love in the midst of constant care. Dirty diapers, crying, smiles, affection, all of the ways that babies are and the constant need. Unconditional love in the midst of all that. Metta, karuna, compassion, being like the mother's or the father's relationship to the child as it gets older and it moves into adolescence. Loving, heartful compassion for all the struggles, all the hurts. Independent happinesses in the world, the parents taking delight, feeling happy themselves for the child's success, the child's happiness. And lastly, upekkha, equanimity. The child grows up and becomes an adult, goes off into the world to live his or her own life in his or her own way. And the mother and father still having a strong, clear love and a deep caring compassion, and are happy for the various successes and joys in their grown-up child's life. But there's a letting be, a kind of letting, just letting be, a balance of wise non-interference, a kind of cooling of attachment in the midst of a loving relationship between the parent and the child. Things are as they are. So the metaphor of the divine abidings in relation to parents and children in an ideal situation. As each of these capacities, these immeasurable threads, metta, karuna, mudita, emerges and grows and matures within us, there is the continually growing thread of equanimity. What is sometimes called the thread of wisdom. Equanimity, also one of the factors of enlightenment. Equanimity, the unshakable mountain. House where I live, we have a sacred mountain. Actually, it's the pueblo, the village of the Tiwa Indians in Taos, that includes this mountain, which is sacred for the Tiwa Indians, sacred for the Tiwa people. I think, though, that the Taos Mountain, it's called Taos Mountain, is in some way a sacred symbol for most people who live in Taos. And I happen to have the good fortune to be able to look out at it and take it in anytime I want to, any day of the year. It's very clearly visible from where I live. This mountain, or any mountain, it just simply sits where it is. The sun shines on it. The rain and the hail falls on top of it. Sometimes snow covers it. Lightning might strike it. Fires might rage on it. All sorts of life forms are born and die on it, living out their particular life patterns on and with the mountain. And the mountain remains unwavering, unshakable. The mountain of radical acceptance, the mountain of equanimity. It itself is a very live energy, very lively energy in itself. And it appropriately sustains and supports the activity that it's intricately and intimately connected to. And all of this happens with the amazing grace of impartiality and balance. The mountain of equanimity. It doesn't cling onto. It's not attached to. It lets life live through itself. This factor of enlightenment, this immeasurable capacity of the heart. And its near enemy, or what might look like equanimity, indifference. Indifference may masquerade as equanimity for us at times. But actually, indifference is a separation. It's really a subtle pulling away. Indifference is actually an aspect of aversion. Indifference creates the duality of you and me, not a connection. The duality of me and them, or me and it. Connection is actually severed with indifference. Life doesn't live through us if we're indifferent. Equanimity is the fearlessness and the power of the heart, the power of the mind to experience all kinds of change, every kind of change, in the realm of form, in the realm of feelings, and in the sometimes startling experiences and changes in the spheres of the six sense doors. In the sphere of the state, our states of mind, within all of the vicissitudes of life, praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, and stay centered, equanimity remaining centered, remaining unshaken. This unshakability, this balance of being, equanimity, is sometimes called the heart of greatness. This immeasurable thread, the thread of wisdom, equanimity. The first three of the divine abidings of the Brahma-viharas are all really based in equanimity. This capacity to embrace, to hold all things, to hold all of life impartially, just as it is, in this moment. Equanimity guards metta. It guards metta and compassion from being dissipated, being weakened in kind of unnecessary or useless involvements, useless quests. And it keeps metta and compassion from getting stuck, from getting lost, or from spinning out in the sometimes seemingly black holes of uncontrolled emotional states. The even-mindedness of equanimity gives metta an even, unchanging firmness, gives it a loyalty. It endows metta with the virtue of patience, patient forbearance that I spoke about a few nights ago. Equanimity furnishes compassion with an even, unwavering courage. It furnishes compassion with a fearlessness. And it provides a calm and a very firm heart, and a calm and firm helping hand, we could say, in and through the acts of compassion. And equanimity also offers a balance to joy. When it sometimes tends to get so carried away with itself, in its own exuberance, that it doesn't see the whole, of a situation, or sense the changing and maybe sometimes painful feelings of another. Equanimity brings a balance to joy. The heart, the mind that has practiced and moved deeply into the sublime states, the divine abidings, has a purity, has a tranquility, and has a firmness. It's easily collected, easily focused. And there's an experiential, very deep experiential understanding of the essential interconnectedness, the total contingency of all things. There's a freedom from much of the selfishness, the self-centeredness that's so binding for us. All of this then provides a foundation from which to live our life, and a foundation from which the fully liberating insight into the nature, the empty, selfless nature of all phenomena can spring. As each of these threads, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, as they grow and they weave together, creating a tapestry, a clear, caring, appropriate responsivity in our life, we live our life more and more from a place of confidence, straightforwardness, strength, this tremendous fullness of energy that the Buddha called the lion's roar. He said that when he himself spoke, it was like the lion's roar in the jungle, because the power of his words was born out of loving care, great compassion, and deep wisdom. I'd like to close the talk with one last story. This is a story that comes out of a larger story from a magazine called Atlantic Monthly. I don't know if you see it here, but it's a story about a young Native American woman. And I have to read it because it's written so beautifully. I'm just going to read it the way it is, so bear with me in terms of the reading part. Sue Ann Marie Big Crow was born on March 15, 1974, at Pine Ridge Hospital on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Sue Ann grew up with her sisters in her mother's three-bedroom house in Pine Ridge. Even today, people talk about what a strict mother Big Chick Big Crow was. Her daughters always had to be in the house or the yard by the time the street lights came on. The only after-school activities she let them take part in were the structured and chaperoned kind, and unsupervised wanderings and later cruising around in cars were out. In an interview when she was a teenager, Sue Ann said that she and her sisters had to come up with their own fun because their mother wouldn't let them socialize outside of school. Chick Big Crow was, and still is, strongly anti-drug and alcohol. On the reservation, Chick belonged for many years to the small but very adamant minority that takes this stance. When Sue Ann was 9 years old, she was staying with her godmother on New Year's Eve when the woman's teenage son came home drunk and shot himself in the chest. The woman was too distraught to do anything, too upset to do anything. So Sue Ann called the ambulance and the police and cared for her until the grown-ups arrived. Perhaps because of this incident, Sue Ann became opposed to drugs and alcohol as much as her mother was. She gave talks on the subjects to school and youth groups, and made a video urging her message in a stern and wooden tone. And as a high schooler, she traveled to distant cities for conventions of like-minded teenagers. I once asked Raul Bradford, a former Pine Ridge teacher and a coach, who's a basketball coach, who is also a friend of the family, whether Sue Ann's public stance on this issue wasn't risky, given the prominence of alcohol in the life of the reservation. You have to understand, Raul Bradford said, Sue Ann didn't respond to peer pressure. Sue Ann was peer pressure. She was the backbone of any group she was in, and she was way wiser than her years. By coming out against drinking, I know that she flat out saved a lot of kids' lives. In fact, she even had an effect on me. It dawned on me that if a 16-year-old girl could have the guts to say things like this, then maybe us adults should pay attention too. I haven't had a drink since the day she died. As strong as Chick forbade certain activities, she encouraged the girls in sports. At one time or another, they did them all: cross-country running and track, volleyball, cheerleading, softball, basketball. When Sue Ann was in the fifth grade, she heard somewhere that to improve your dribbling, basketball, bouncing, she should bounce a basketball 1,000 times a day with each hand. She performed this daily exercise faithfully on the cement floor of the patio. Her mother and her sisters got very tired of the sound. For variety, she would shoot layup shots against the gutter and the drain pipe until they came loose from the house and had to be repaired. Sue Ann tended to get into foul trouble in basketball games, as the referees rule very strictly in tournament games, and Sue Ann was used to a more headlong or rough style of play. In the district playoffs against the team from the Red Cloud Reservation, Sue Ann scored 31 points. Some people who live in cities and towns near Indian reservations treat their Indian neighbors decently. Some don't. Some people in South Dakota hate Indians unapologetically and will tell you why. In their voices, you can hear a particular American meanness that is centuries old. When teams from Pine Ridge play non-Indian teams, the question of race is always there. When Pine Ridge is the visiting team, usually the hosts are courteous and the players and fans have a good time. But Pine Ridge coaches know that occasionally at away games, their kids will be insulted. Their fans will feel unwelcome. The host gym will be dense with hostility. And the referees will call fouls on Indian players every chance they get. Sometimes in a game between Indian and non-Indian teams, the difference in race becomes an important and distracting part of the event. One place where Pine Ridge teams used to get harassed regularly was the high school gymnasium in Lead, South Dakota. In the fall of 1988, the Pine Ridge Lady Thorps, that's the name of the basketball team, went to Lead, South Dakota to play a basketball game. Sue Ann was a full member of the team by then. She was a freshman in high school, 14 years old. Getting ready in the locker room, the Pine Ridge girls could hear the din, the noise, from the Lead fans out in the gym. They were yelling fake Indian war cries, a woo 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 sound. The usual plan for the pregame warm-up was for the visiting team to run onto the court in a line, take a lap around one or two laps around the floor, shoot some baskets, and then go to their bench at courtside. After that, the home team would come out and do the same, and then the game would begin. Usually the Thorpe's team lined up for their entry more or less according to height, which meant that the senior, high school senior Donnie DeCorey, one of the tallest, went first. As the team waited in the hallway leading from the locker room, the noise, the heckling, got louder and louder. Some fans were waving food stamps, a reference to the reservation receiving federal aid. Reservation, people living on the reservation receiving federal aid, food aid. Others were yelling, "Where's the cheese?" The joke being that if Indians were lining up, it must be to get some government commodity cheese. The Lead High School band had joined in with fake Indian drumming and a fake Indian tune. Donnie DeCorey looked out the door and told her teammates, "I can't handle this." Sue Ann quickly offered to go first in her place. She was so eager that Donnie became suspicious. "Don't embarrass us," Donnie told her. Sue Ann said, "I won't. I won't embarrass you." Donnie gave her the ball, and Sue Ann stood first in line. She came running onto the court, dribbling the basketball, with her teammates running behind. On the court, the noise was deafening. Sue Ann went right down the middle and suddenly stopped when she got to center court. Her teammates were taken by surprise, and some bumped into each other. Coach Zamiga, the basketball coach at the rear of the line, didn't know why they'd stopped. Sue Ann turned to Donnie DeCorey and tossed her the ball. Then she stepped into the jump ball circle at center court, facing the Lead fans. She unbuttoned her warm-up jacket, took it off, draped it over her shoulders, and began to do the Lakota shawl dance. Sue Ann knew all the traditional dances. She had competed in many powwows as a little girl, and the dance she chose is a young woman's dance, graceful and modest and show-offy at the same time. "I couldn't believe it. She was powwowing like Get Down," Donnie DeCorey recalls. Does that translate? No? Powwow is a gathering of Native Americans that it's a spiritual practice. They dance, they do their dances together, and they sing. That's a powwow, and it's a practice, and that they start learning when they're children. So Donnie DeCorey, who was her cousin actually, said she was powwowing like get. What expression did she use? Like Get Down. It's like really doing it. Really, really doing it. She was powwowing like Get Down. And then Sue Ann started to sing. Sue Ann began to sing in Lakota, swaying back and forth in the jump ball circle, doing the shawl dance, using her warm-up jacket for a shawl. The crowd went completely silent. All that stuff the Lead fans were yelling, it was like she reversed it somehow, a teammate says. In the sudden quiet, all they could hear was her Lakota song. Sue Ann dropped her jacket, took the ball from Donnie DeCorey, and ran a lap around the court, dribbling her ball, bouncing her ball expertly and fast. The audience began to cheer and applaud. She sprinted to the basket, went up in the air, and laid the ball right through the hoop, with the fans cheering loudly now. Of course, Pine Ridge went on to win that basketball game. And the author ends his story saying, "I cannot find evidence of a single act as elegant, as generous, as transcendent as Sue Ann's dance at Center Court, in the gym at Lead. The lion's roar. Let's sit for a moment. Thank you for listening to the Dharma.